Hello and welcome back to the Lumieres podcast. This show is a slowly weaving thread, bringing together people with a gift, a story, or a mission to share at the intersection where creative expression, holistic health, and grounded spirituality meet. I'm your host, Jody White. So my guest today is a modern alchemist. She's a herbalist and she's also a ceremonial facilitator. I'm talking about the very wonderful Charlotte Pulver. So quite a few years ago now, I was down chatting with Mark Golding, dropping by as I was passing through Sussex. I'd brought him a bottle of my homemade kombucha, which we shared outside his cabin. This was also the time when he told me that I should call my first book Chimera, and a light went on in my head. While we were chatting, he asked me if I knew Charlotte Pulver, as they had been getting on really well and he spoke very highly of her work. This was how I first heard of Charlotte. In the years since, I've seen her pop up at festivals and followed her pilgrimage work. And I always thought she'd be great on the podcast talking about her craft. And so I dropped Charlotte a line, very happy that she was up for it. And we had a great conversation a couple of months or so ago. And we actually started this conversation by reminiscing about the time each of us first met the remarkable artist and human that was Mark Golding. If you go back to the podcast archives and look for the early episodes, there is one that I recorded with Mark at his home in the Sussex Woods. Sadly, he died last year and is greatly missed by many. His incredible art, however, does live on and can be viewed online at markgolding.co.uk. If you'd like to follow Charlotte, her Instagram is at pulvers.apothecary, and she is also on Facebook. And I just want to say thank you so much, Charlotte, for sharing your time, your life and your insight with us. A quick message before we begin. If you're in Hay on Wye for the Literary Festival, I'll be speaking about my debut memoir, Chimera, at North Books in one of their 4 o'clock Friends slots. That's on 4 p.m. on Wednesday, the 31st of May, at North Books in Hay on Wye, and it is free to attend. If you'd like to keep informed of what else I'm up to, I have started recently putting out a simple monthly newsletter, which you can sign up for at my website, which is www.jodywhite.co.uk/sign-up. On Instagram, you can find me at Life in Fractals. The podcast is at Lumieres Podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for telling people about this show. I hope you enjoyed the latest run of episodes. And if you did, you can always drop me a line. I love to receive emails or messages on social media from people who listen. But now, take very good care of yourselves until the next time. And here is my conversation with Charlotte Pulver.
How did I meet Mark? It's a bit of a story. 2012. And I found myself at Stonehenge on summer solstice sunrise. Inside the henge.
Wow.
And not that I was planning to be there, but it just happened. We just ended up there with friends. And it's the first time that I'd been inside. And all I'd heard was the place to make your prayers is at this one particular stone called the Hell Stone. It's spelled H-E-L. It's kind of, it is in alignment with the summer solstice sunrise. So if the sun is rising and the skies are clear and, you know, and it hits that stone, the hellstone, on the morning sunrise of the solstice. And then a shadow forms from the hellstone and goes along the ground and into the centre of the henge, into the inner circle and pierces the altar stone. So it's like it's a bit like fertility.
Wow.
And so I don't know, I leant against the hellstone, and by then you're so delirious if you've stayed up all night inside Stonehenge and it gets so cold and it's you know, quite a crazy atmosphere. Everyone's just having a rave. Like 10,000s of people, and it's like all sorts of people. It's hilarious. Anyway, I was so delirious. I was just like just leant against the hearthstone. And the prayer that came through was, I wish to connect more deeper with the waters of the British Isles. That was my prayer. That's just what came through in that moment. And it was, you know, just that's, you know, when you're in that deliriously tired, cold, liminal space, that's what came to me. And then when I got home after the adventure to Stonehenge, back to London where I was living, I just went onto Facebook that evening. And, you know, I was part of the Zoo Studios Facebook group.
Yeah.
You know, which quite many people are of Lewis. And I just clicked onto that and immediately popped up this picture of the spring. Which Mark Golding had posted up. But this first time I kind of saw it. And I was like, so that was in June 2012. And I just immediately messaged him back. I was like, oh, that's the answer to the prayer at Stonehenge. I was just like, that's what dropped in. It's like, that's the answer. It's answered. And often I find whenever anyone makes prayers at the Hearthstone on the solstice, the prayers are answered so quickly.
Okay.
Very quickly. And so I was like, oh, that's it. So I immediately messaged him. I was like, I really need to visit this spring. And I'd love to meet you.
Did you tell him about the prayer?
No. Because, you know.
First time.
Didn't know each other. You know, even though he probably.
But I would imagine he would have been the sort of guy that if you told him about that, he would have been like, oh my goodness, you have to come now, kind of thing, you know. Yeah. Very receptive.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
but
totally.
It all sounds like it was divinity anyway.
Yeah. So, you know, as you know, Mark, super humble. And he was just like, well, I can give you a map and then, you know, you can find it when the time is right. And so it took me actually 6 months to get to Hastings. You know how it is.
Mm.
Anyone who's listening to this who lives in London, you know, you can just get stuck in London.
In the orbit, yeah.
Yeah. So I have a birthday in December. And so that year I decided I've got to bathe in the spring. And my birthday that year was on 12/12/12. So I was like, got it. This is it. Gonna go in the spring on that day. And it happened to be, of course, a zoo party on for 12/12/12.
Right. Okay.
So I was like, go to Hastings and go to zoo party, dip in the spring. And so, I found it very powerful meeting the spring for the first time. And little did I know that on bathing in that spring and starting to work that spring, that the waters and the energy of that place would radically start to change my life within a whole year. Yeah. So yeah, wow. There's a lot of change. And then I started to find out more about the pre-Christian goddess to St. Helen, which the spring is named after. But after my bathe, then I met met Mark at the zoo party.
Oh, he was there. That's
yeah,
great.
Yeah. And so that's how we met, finally.
Right after you'd been in the spring. How perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. So where, let's rewind a little bit and like, so where did you grow up? You're not from, natively, where did you grow up?
So I was born in the USA.
You're born in America, okay.
Yeah, in Florida.
Okay.
In Miami.
Yeah.
So my dad's American. My mum's Canadian British.
Okay.
So I was born in Miami, which was an incredible childhood. People think of Miami as Miami Vice.
Yeah.
And glitz and glam and all that, but it's only a slither.
Okay.
It's only a...
There's always many sides to a place though, right?
Yeah. But also because people see just Miami as Miami Beach, which is one part. But if you go away from the beach, it's ancient rainforest.
Mm.
And you only have to dig down a few inches and it's just all fossilized coral reef.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's the energy. It's very intensely feminine and receptive.
Okay.
But also electric. It's like coral reef is like primordial brain. So you've got coral reef and swamp and ancient rainforests. And I mean, Florida has the most amount of springs in it than anywhere in the world.
Does it really? Wow. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so it's a huge aquifer underneath
it. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So you were born into the place of the waters in a way.
Yeah. It was everywhere. And Miami is in the Tequesta First Nation language means big water.
Okay, right. Mm. Okay. Yeah. And did you, I mean, when you were growing up, did you feel a connection to water? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, anyone who knows Florida and anyone knows, you know, who lives in the tropics, because it's pure tropics there, you're always in the water.
Mm. Yeah.
You're always in the water.
Yeah.
Always at the beach.
Yeah. It's so hot, I guess, as well. And yeah. The storms you get there are amazing. I remember, we went there once when I was a kid with my family, the classic kind of. Was it not Disney World? What's the other one?
Yeah,
MGM or something.
Oh, MGM.
Yeah,
Universal.
One of those places.
Yeah.
And I remember the one of the craziest storms I ever saw was there, and it was like thunder and lightning, and just like so fantastical tropical storm.
Yeah.
So you get the kind of like that side of it as well. The like waters from above just falling.
Yeah. The hurricanes. We have hurricanes every year. They call it hurricane season over a 3-month period. And from what I understand and what I've learned from friends who live there or been brought up there, you know, only certain kind of personality can hack that kind of climate and life. Because every year there'll be really intense hurricanes which come in. And sometimes they're so intense you have to evacuate your home.
Right.
And that's just common and normal.
Yeah.
And it's wild, and it's that lends it a real wildness. It's just like nature is so big in that way, and it's the humidity. So like you feel like you're covered in water all the time. It's like the air is breathing, you know.
I like that. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
It's a whole different thing, right?
I love it. It's so crazy and wild.
So you grew up there, did you? You didn't move over here.
So when I was 10,
you moved to England.
Yeah. My mom didn't really like Florida, Miami. She couldn't really hack it.
Okay. Well, where was she from in Canada?
She was in like Manitoba in the center.
Okay, so not quite the same climate then.
Yeah, cold.
Dry, cold. Yeah.
And her mother was back in the UK. She'd lived in the UK most of her life. And she just like, I can't deal with this crazy tropical climate. I mean, it's so crazy.
Fair enough. So you came to the UK when you were 10.
Yeah.
And
I wasn't happy about that.
No. Well, it's quite a place to leave, I guess, if you've spent your first 10 years of life getting really used to this is my home.
Yeah.
That's a big shift.
Yeah, we like had a mango farm.
Really?
Yeah, and I like had tree houses and mango trees.
And idyllic, like,
and kind of lived outside like that all the time.
Mm.
And then to come to England where it's like really cold, and yeah, I was a very brash young American girl. And it was such a culture shock for me because my parents divorced, that's what happened.
Oh, I see.
And so like my mom was single mom, and
your dad stayed in America.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's usual that parents can do this without contemplating it sometimes. She wanted me to have the upbringing that she had, which was to go to boarding school.
Right.
So it's from the tropics to England in a boarding school. And I was just like, what is this weird place where they tell you you don't talk properly, eat properly, I don't know.
Wow.
Behave properly.
Like going from freedom to like restrictivity, the most really confined, like rigid sort of rules, I guess.
Rigidity. And I was just like, oh God, what is this? So for a few years, didn't last for long, but initially I was like, I hate England and go USA.
I mean, that's understandable, really.
So yeah, that was just, you know, that's very... polarized in my views on it all.
Was there a moment that marked like a shift in your attitude? Was it time, or was it like specific places or people, or just when did you first feel a little more settled in on this land?
I mean, I always felt like I had a magical connection with the UK.
Yeah.
From very young, because I would come and visit my grandmother every summer.
Okay.
She lived in the countryside and, you know, it was just a whole new plant world to get to know, you know. So I remember at that age of 3 or 4, just like walking through meadows and wildflowers and, you know, the typical traditional.
Yeah, like, very different from Florida.
Yeah, but I was totally vibing with them all. Mm. And also like yew trees, which we don't have in southern Florida. So like all these really ancient trees and big oaks, you know. Mm. So I was totally vibing with them and, you know, felt really like welcome in that way. But in relation to culturally, like I think it started to change in my early teens, around 14 and 15, when I discovered that this was obviously in the 90s. I was just like,
great time to be a teenager.
England was erupting into the rave scene. And a simple way to put it is for children, or I mean young adults, to go to clubs, go to raves, it's not as restricted as this USA. And so I was like going raving at the age of 14 to some really just incredible places. I mean, my church was something called the Whirligig.
Right.
And it started in like Shoreditch in East London. And it was just epic. And I just couldn't like miss any Whirligig rave.
Were these like kind of several days, all night? And then the next day, or was it just like a kind of a night?
It was just a night. I mean, it was just so bizarre in the way that they ran it. I mean, it still is happening in London, but they only do it like once a month.
If it's still happening?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
As in there's never been a...
Yeah.
It's never gone, right, we're kind of quitting.
No.
Wow, that must be probably one of the only nights that's like that, right? Yeah.
So back then... I mean, it was just, so back then, so it took place in like Shoreditch Town Hall. Back then, you know, Shoreditch wasn't like trendy as it is and open in that way. It was just like, oh, you're going all the way there? Okay. and it was just such, it had such a cult following. Like people would line up for hours.
Before, what kind of music were they playing?
So it was.
Like housey stuff?
No, not house. It was drum and bass. Techno trance and wild, and then at the end of the evening, which was always at midnight, it was so chill. They had this huge like silk parachute which was like hanging on the ceiling, and then it like came down, and then everyone just like laid on the ground
on the parachute.
No, so they're under the parachute and people were holding the parachute and going like this,
wafting it,
and so you had this like silk waft, and then obviously with all the psychedelic lights hitting the parachute and like really like great 90s trance music, and then everyone's like lying on top of each other like obviously in like various, melting with MDMA or XC or whatever, just massaging, you just became this whole love puddle.
Wow.
So that happened like at midnight, and then so it kind of went on from 6 p.m. to 2,
yeah,
kind of unique in that way. And the rules were, if you were there and you were under 12 with your parents, you could go.
Under 12?
I know.
Wow.
But then if you were over 12, so between 12 and 18, not allowed. And then obviously you need proof of ID, you know, to show that you're 18 and over. So like at the age of 14, obviously not supposed to be there, but I would go, I would go up to people in the line and ask them to be my mom.
Great, I love it. That was great. Did it work?
Yeah, it did. And I have lots of what I call Whirligig mums, and I'm still in contact. I'm still in contact with them.
That's so good. I love it. That's great. So that's a pretty formative experience to have at 14.
Yeah.
Right. There can't be that many 14-year-olds, especially these days, that experience would happen to.
No.
No.
Yeah. No, it was so powerful for a lot of people, that place. And yeah, met lifelong friends there. And also took friends from boarding school to it who would never dream going, you know. And it was amazing. There's those people like jamming and drum circles and yeah. And like, you know, it was during that kind of like psychedelic rave scenes that everyone really thought about their outfit.
Some great costumes going on.
Yeah. Oh, so brilliant. I would think about my outfit. What am I going to wear this week?
That's amazing. Wow. I mean, that's going to make you appreciate the UK a bit more, I suppose.
Yeah. So like, it was the rave scene which helped me appreciate England culturally. And then I would go back to visit my dad in the summer holidays and be like, God, you guys.
There's nothing like that there.
Nothing.
Mm.
And, you know, I think you have to be over 21 to drink and stuff like that.
In America, yeah.
And even I did go to like these few of these festivals, like day festivals, but it was so corporate even back then.
Mm, mm.
And I was just like, this is bullshit. Mm. You know, I knew earlier on, and you know, mm. I'd been to Glastonbury at the age of 16 for the first time, just walked in because you could
yeah.
get in quite
so
easily.
So envious of that time.
And so I was comparing what my friends were up to in the USA, and I was like, guys, you don't really have much freedom, do you? It's all this corporate MTV bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they were coming over to the UK.
Wow, you sold it that hard.
They were coming over to the UK for their holidays, and they're just like, oh my God. Oh my God.
So you're like initiating all your friends. And
yeah. And so it was through the rave scene, the music and the festivals, mm. which it's like, okay, we can like the UK. And then through being, you know, out on the land raving, not that I was looking for it, but you end up going to these all like really magical secret sites. And that's, you know, then that's how I first came across them. Like how I found Glastonbury Tours, like we were just driving down to Cornwall and passing by Glastonbury. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning and I saw a sign saying Glastonbury Tour. I was like, wow, that's not the festival. Okay, this is something else. Let's climb it.
Brilliant.
In the dark, but yeah. not knowing the way up.
Yeah, yeah.
So we kind of like walk through the fields with the cows and the sheep and crawling in the wind. It was great.
Isn't that interesting how it's sort of mirrors the way that some of these sites they think may have been used for, you know, there's yeah. some evidence about they've kind of scientifically analyzed the ground and said okay. in some of these sacred sites and said like, yeah, dancing did take place here.
Oh.
So that I love that connection that
that's so cool.
there's still something later on way down the line, like hundreds and hundreds of years later, that people want to go to these places and dance. It's still sort of in us, you know, that we know in yeah. a way.
Yeah.
And so I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a way
too.
Of connecting, isn't it? I guess it's just the modern version of trying to reconnect with the land in that way and with ourselves and our bodies, because it's so empowering to move your body, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah, and instead of, you know, and the music that we use is electronic trance music to you know, or repetitive.
But it's the tools of the modern version. Of
yeah,
like
it's the modern version.
Banging a drum.
I know.
Or, you know,
and I love that.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And it's, from what I've heard, I mean, I haven't been to the legal rave in so long, but it's still going on.
Yeah. Well, they were in the news in the lockdowns, I think, weren't they? There was a party. People were putting on parties still.
In Wales?
Yeah.
There was a massive one.
There was one.
It was so funny.
Yeah. Is that the one with this video of
were
it? I think that was really near where...
They were interviewing some like elderly Welsh people from the village, and they're like...
Oh. On the Black Mountains. It wasn't far from me at the time, I remember.
Okay.
But no one I knew had heard of it, and it just sort of popped up. Amazing. Like people will dance, won't they?
Yeah,
they'll do a lot. They'll risk a lot and do a lot to have those experiences.
They will,
which I think is quite incredible.
Yeah,
the human desire to, you know, they want to do that so much that, like, yeah,
yeah,
powerful stuff.
Yeah, and I know like people who are like my you know, my age bracket in the 40s or 50s, and they just like, man, they kind of just feel like they need something, even, and then they'll find it in a like illegal rave. It's like, yeah, that is what I needed, just to work something out, you know, and go on a mission.
Yeah. The mission side of it. This is the mission side of it, right? Like,
yeah.
I remember we had it on when I was a teenager. It was on a really small scale, but it was like there was a small crew of people in the town that I grew up.
Yeah.
That would just go and set up somewhere out in the countryside with some speakers and stuff, and have like a mini version of that. They'd only be really small, like 50 people, but
nice. It
was still that, like, right, what the mission is. We've got to find the right spot. Then we've got to plan when it's going to be. Then we've got to make sure that, you know, we can get away with it and it won't get shut down by the police or something.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of, it's so exciting.
Yeah.
It's like a real sense of like, wow, it's a secret.
Secret. We got the gear, we got the sound system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. There's so many, it's interesting. There's a lot of people who later in life went towards the sort of down the sort of nature connection, be that through medicine, herbalism, you know, an opening to like a spirituality of their own, who started off in the rave scene. Like there's a, do you know Rachel Corby?
I know the name. Yeah, she's great. She's a Stroud.
Herbalist.
Yeah. She's wonderful.
She's really, yeah, she's great. Hi, Rachel, if you're listening. I know you do sometimes. And she started off in the rave scene as well.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. The kind of like, I guess you're opening yourself and you're going in, you're taking off a lot of layers at a very young age, I guess, when you're in that scene, and you're opening up to something, to yourself, I guess, as well. So maybe, I don't know, it's just, there's just something about that. There's a little line that I've seen that sort of connects people who were around at that time and then later on went to do, let's just say, like, it felt like they found their calling after that. You know, it was like an opening, and then that allowed like a pathway to form.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sense. That's just my sort of like, I've just made that up on the spot.
No. I mean, for me directly, it was during that era for me, those years, where then the herbal studies happened very strongly.
Was that your first field of sort of natural health medicine that you were interested in, the herbal side of things?
So, I mean, how it happened was quite funny. So like 14, 15, like obviously, you know, going to these places with all these chemicals and trying LSD for the first time and ecstasy. Yeah, I had some great times, but, you know, I learned very quickly that my system was really sensitive, and, you know, I maybe had a bad E or a bad LSD, and I was just like, no, I don't like that. I'm not going to go through that again. So it's not like I didn't take much, but I tried pretty much everything and found out that my body couldn't take drugs like my friends could.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, and then I couldn't even drink tea or coffee without like spazzing. No, seriously. And I didn't know why. I just had this really sensitive system. And thankfully I had the presence of mind even at that age. So, okay, we're just not going to do that. But I was just like, I'm still determined to rave, so I'm going to look at herbs. So at the age of 14, I was like opening.
That's amazing.
So I was like, I was like opening up these like herb books, and I'm like, I'm just going to make my own stuff. And I did.
The confidence though, that's really interesting. You had the confidence do you think you always had that confidence of kind of like, I want to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to look it up and I'm going to do it.
There's a determination, especially like when you're that age, you're like, and you're so into your rave church, which for me was really good, and you're just so into the scene. I'm like, I'm still going to rave, so I'm going to do it my way.
Brilliant.
And at the time, so like I was brought up in London after Florida, so it doesn't exist anymore, but wow, and an amazing place for teenagers to go to was Kensington Market. And in the basement, you know, they had all these like head shops and stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's this one little shop And in his head shop, he sold herbal ecstasy and like all the herbs.
I remember that time, yeah.
Yeah. And so like, I was like, he was like, you should try this. And, you know, I read the ingredients. I could see what was in it. And it was amazing, you know. And so that's when I started to understand what the herbs were, which had the similar experience of ecstasy and the euphoria. And then I just naturally started looking it all up. And back then, there was a lot of herbs, which now are illegal.
Yeah.
And they really work.
Yeah.
Like kava kava. Do you know that one?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was totally legal back then.
It was illegal back
then. No, legal.
Illegal, yeah. And I remember we used to use, because I had a similar pathway through going to these things and finding out I was really sensitive and then looking for alternatives. I used to really like ephedra.
Yeah, ephedra.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was like kava kava ephedra. And cause ephedra is a Chinese, you know, herb that they use for people who have asthma and stuff. Opens up the, you know, the bronchioles, the lungways. But, you know, if you're taking a higher dose, it's really quite ecstatic.
It's quite strong as well, isn't it?
It's very ecstatic. Yeah. And what else? And just I found like really like simple combinations, like just like guarana with something called calamus.
Mm-hmm.
Calamus together, which is First Nation peoples in North America use it for trance. So a trancey thing with a guarana, which is the opposite. But together it was epic, for example. And I learned that just by trying it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And I just one time was taking guarana and calamus. I had the most amazing, like, totally spiritual experience on the dance floor to the point where I felt like I'd really cleared myself out to the point I had so much healing energy coming from my hands and radiating from my whole body.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like more so than you'd had previously on like chemical based substances.
You wouldn't be able to experience that on chemicals. Yeah. But it was more like I suddenly like put my hands together. I was like, whoa, there is so much like electricity and like chi or mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like with a friend, I was like, can you feel that? And she's like, yeah. And so I ended up doing all these like healings on everyone. Like in the middle of like
brilliant, I love
the you know, I was 15 at the time.
Yeah, amazing.
And then like, you know, you have these like big euphoric experiences, and this is just with taking these two very simple herbs.
Yeah.
And just having great music and really having a good dance. So I was a bit like, guys, I need to like ground this energy. So after the rave would stop, I persuade them to drive to what was it called? Hyde Park, that's it.
Hyde Park.
Yeah, and we just like climb the fence at like 3 a.m, just going on. I know this sounds totally hippie, but this is what I needed. Just go and hug trees.
To
ground.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I had so much euphoria running through my being.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we would go to Hyde Park and hang out the trees after raves.
Brilliant. I love it. That's so great.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were the only person, were you sort of alone in this approach, or were there other people at the time who were more like, did you find people who were also on that sort of way?
No, not that I found other friends like making potions and experimenting. I was the only one in my friend group, but they were coming to me like, we want to try what you're trying. Can we try it?
Mm.
And like these people were like very high tolerance, and they'll be like, having an epic experience after what I'd given them. And just like almost remember one friend saying, Charlotte, I feel like I'm literally levitating.
It worked.
Yeah.
And then did you feel, I guess, was there something about the, how it felt to you to help people, to give people an experience through a natural form that you kind of on some level think, I want to do this, I want to explore this, I want to kind of, or was it at that age you're sort of, did you think, I want to follow this more, like I want to learn more, you know? Or were you still just like in it, in the experiences?
I was in the experience. I just knew like at the age of 18, like I just wanted to I mean, back then, you know, like there's so much incredible places for people to learn different channels of healing arts. You could go to university and do herbalism course or acupuncture. Back then there was nothing of that nature.
Okay.
And I was just like, oh my God, what's offered to me at university? I don't want to study in any of that. You know what I mean? And back then you could go to uni for free.
Yeah.
So my parents were like, Charlotte,
what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? And the only thing I could bear the thought of studying was anthropology. So I applied to do that. And I mean, God, it's quite a story from then on.
What do you mean?
Yeah, it's quite a story.
Anthropology?
Yeah, so because what it was is I guess I was drawn to medical anthropology. So studying the
how people have used things. And
so studying the medical practices in all various different cultures. So so I applied to do that, but very like half-heartedly, because I was just like, I don't want to do any of this.
The study, do you think it was, or just the what?
No, because there's just nothing at uni I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I honestly just wanted to go straight into the healing arts.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was at a very, should we say, elite school and in London. And, you know,
was it kind of frowned upon if somebody wanted to do that outside of the main sort of route? It was like everybody goes to university. No, it was just like
unheard of. It's like you go to uni, it's free, and you've gone to all this schooling. So I was just like, oh, I'm just going to apply for anthropology. Half-heartedly, you know? And then what happened was I took a year out, and that year out changed everything.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you do on the year out?
God. Oh, wow. It literally changed everything. Okay, I could talk about it. I have never really spoken about this so publicly. I've, you know.
Are you okay speaking?
Yeah. So, I've only shared this with friends. But it was, it changed my life, and I'm glad it happened, though it was very fierce. So, you know, I just got a round the world ticket.
Ah, okay.
You know, back then you could get a round the world ticket for nothing.
Yeah,
I did the most cliched stuff, like go to India, and the first place I went to was Goa.
Of course.
In the 90s. No, not the first place. I kind of ended up in Goa. I did go to some very wild places in India before it ended up in Goa. Anyway, so imagine Goa in the 90s. Huge trance scene.
It's kind of a mix, in a way, it's sort of like a mixture of your roots, right? It's like the hot, the trancey rave culture, but in the hot location of the sort of
tropics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you feel at home there?
Yeah, the nature for sure.
Mm.
I was 18, and God, you know, at 18, you think you got your shit together, but you so don't got your shit together at all.
Yeah, you were basically a child still, really.
Totally, and so easily persuaded. And so, I don't know, I was just like hanging out with this, should we say, not the right crowd.
Okay.
And I think... Yeah, I think what it was is I'd injured myself, not hugely, just from riding a motorcycle. I burnt, hot oil got on my foot, and so it got infected. So I couldn't go out raving or whatever and like go to the pace that my friends were going at. And at that age, and when you're a teenager, what often can happen is you want to have such a good time that you're willing to risk your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, and it happens when we don't have a rites of passage in our culture.
True.
Yeah. And so I was just really not thinking. And what was going on in Goa, and I wouldn't be surprised if it still happens in various places in India. You could go to the pharmacy, and they would give you really quite strong chemical drugs.
Yeah.
And so what they were giving out, and I didn't know anything about what they were giving me, was something called liquid methamphetamine.
Okay.
Which is liquid speed.
So
it would come in a vial, and so the reason why they had it and why it was legal behind their counter is because if someone's having a heart attack, it can bring you back to life.
Okay, right.
And often they'll inject it
right
into the heart. Anyway, he was just like, hey, little girl, is this what you want to rave with? Liquid speed. You did tell me anything about the dosage.
Oh, God. This is, yeah.
Yeah. So cut a long story short, I took way too much. I had a highly huge overdose. Ended up in hospital. Nearly died.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Mm. Left completely on my own. The people who I thought were my friends totally abandoned me.
Yeah.
So I was just like, whoa, I've just had a heart seizure. I'm in a Goa hospital. I nearly died. Like, honestly, had the whole death experience.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, had it all. And there was a point in the death experience where I was given a choice, stay or go.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very clear, like I can remember as so clear, like now, that in the moment, like my spirit was like, no, I don't want to die now. I'm not going to go.
Mm.
And obviously going through something like that was so traumatic for my nervous system. And at such a young age in the country that I was in, that I was in a lot of trauma, but I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying to the doctors in the hospital, and they, you know, checked me out, and, you know, they could help me to the level they could. But they said, you need to go back to the UK and be checked out properly by a cardiologist.
Right, wow.
So you need to go home.
Yeah.
Find yourself. And all I wanted to do was get home after that experience.
Yeah.
And what I kept on saying to the doctors was like, can you help me get home? Can you help me? Can you help me get home? And there's this one Indian doctor, and he said to me, Charlotte, we've done everything we can. So I shouldn't try and do the accent.
It's okay. That's how he spoke.
And because often Indian friends and like mine are like, Charlotte, stop it. You sound like you're like Welsh or something.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, he's just like, Charlotte, we've done everything we can. What you need to do, you need to learn how to meditate. he's like that is gonna take you home.
Amazing.
That's what he literally said to me.
Amazing. Wow.
And then as soon as I said that, I literally was like, in my teenage willfulness, I was like, really? How can I find out about meditation? And he's like, go and read about it. There's a good library in the hospital. We got some amazing books. Like, but these are like old school Indian books, you know, nothing new agey at all. Like, brilliant. I still actually have one of them.
Really?
It was just like this little book, and it's just so perfect the way it had been written. And he's like, Charlotte, meditation is going to help you come home. And I'm like, okay.
I trust you. Yeah.
All right. And I was so determined, and it took me a while to, and also for the hospital, to figure out how they could get me home, like just get a flight ticket. I mean, I couldn't do anything anyway.
Right. Were you kind of like in a wheelchair? Or?
I was completely incapacitated.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I nearly died.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So the recovery time must have been...
a few weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shoo.
Yeah. And so... I just had my little meditation book.
I'm going home.
Exactly. And I just thought, because, you know, it's a really busy hospital. You didn't have much time to yourself. So I'm like, right, I'm going to escape and find my way onto the hospital roof. And I'm going to meditate.
Onto the hospital roof. I love it. Closer to the source.
Yeah. And that's how it happened.
You need to get high.
So it started.
Wow.
And so then I went home to get checked out by the cardiologist, and he was just like, ah, you have a congenital heart situation. Like, you were born with, when your valves doesn't close properly, mitral valve doesn't close properly. So my question to you is, how do you feel when you drink tea and coffee? And I'm like, no, I don't like it. I feel really spazzy. And he's like, yeah, because you've got an irregular heartbeat. Your valve doesn't shut properly. It's strange that they've never picked this up.
Yeah.
And then, like, he just looked at me. He's like, just so you know, I really wouldn't advise taking any more drugs. Because you were born this way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, at the age of 18, that's when all the experimentation and curiosity with chemicals just ceased to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had had a total near-death experience, I was just so happy to be alive. I'm not going to go back there again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Mm. It's like one sort of phase of life is just, there's a door closed on that.
Yeah.
It's like, no. Mm.
And I hear this from other people who have had near-death experiences.
I did around the same age.
Did you?
Mm, I had leukemia when I was 17.
Oh, wow.
And ended up with that wasn't the kind of most crazy part of it. It was probably when I ended up in the intensive care with pneumonia and MRSA at the same time. And it was like, that was the night that was touch and go.
Yeah.
And when I had to, like, I was having crazy dreams, being inside my body and all sorts of amazing stuff. But that was my moment of like, hang on, the world will never be the same now. You know, you can't see things with the same eyes after an experience like that.
No, exactly.
It just kind of breaks down everything that you thought was what the life was about, you know.
Yeah.
And how you are in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, so totally relate to that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So after I had an experience for about 2 years, I was just completely fearless. Don't know if you went through that.
I was only 17, 18 as well. So yeah. I felt a bit special. I'd survived for a reason.
Aww.
I had that like slight kind of like, yeah, slight fearlessness. It was like, well, if that's where it can be, that's how close death can be. And it's, you know, that's what it is. Then I've kind of tasted it a little bit now. So I'm not as scared.
Mm.
So yeah, I did have a slight.
Yeah.
But it's multiple layers of stuff. There's like, sometimes that's at the front, and then other times you're kind of like, oh, but I'm the different person now. I'm so fragile because I've had all this crazy treatment.
Of course.
And, you know, there's all
especially
these layers.
When you're going through that.
The mental stuff, you know, after going through something big as a, I'm sure you kind of experienced that as well. Like the mental side of things after you go through such a big experience at a young age, when you're still, like we said, you're not a full grown, mature, wise adult at that stage. They're trying to make sense of what happened to you. There's that side of it as well, of like, whoa, something really big's just happened and I'm different and life isn't ever going to be the same, but I don't quite know yet how all the pieces land.
Integration. Mm. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So how did you feel when you were like kind of ready to go back into the world?
So after I'd like got checked out by the cardiologist, I just looked at him and my poor mother, I mean, God, going through that ordeal, you know, on the other side of the world. I said to him, so like, can I just go back to India? Yeah. And like, can I go up tall mountains like the Himalayas? And he just looked at me, he's like, yeah, totally fine. I was just, there was this fearlessness of like, right, I'm going back, obviously not going to be the wrong crowd and take chemicals. It was like, right, I want to go to Nepal and Tibet and just carry on. What I'd set out to do that year, I wasn't going to just
amazing
be stuck. But this time I was like, I'm doing this on my own. Mm-hmm. I don't need anyone.
Mm.
It was very like that.
On your own terms as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I had this fear about traveling, especially in India, on my own as a woman as well. But that had all just dissolved. I was like, I'm okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I headed for Nepal. And and to trek into the Himalayas. Walked into what's called the Kingdom of Mustang. So it's actually a medieval kingdom.
Oh, right, wow.
Yeah, definitely look it up. People are Tibetan.
So it's a settlement that's been ongoing since that time, do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's its own kingdom.
Its own kingdom, right, okay.
Ancient. Mm. So, and you can't get there by road. You have mm-hmm. to walk, or people, you know, if people have the money, they take a helicopter. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I walked there, ended up there. And, you know, I was getting really touched by the Tibetan culture. It was really having an influence on me. And I remember I was staying with a Tibetan family, and like there was a girl, she's probably about six, and she was like helping her family, and she had a really bad burn on her hand. And it was affecting her being able to do stuff. It was like getting infected. And I just looked at it and I was like, I know how to treat that. And I just, and I'd actually from a very young age always just had my potions and herbs and was always treating stuff. I really did have the right stuff for this burn, these different tinctures to pour it into. And it got better really quickly. And I don't know, something happened in that moment. It was just like, oh, this is what I want to be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Just seeing the impact, it's like...
It was just something came through. Mm. And, you know, and it's something often also came through. And I don't know where it came from, to be honest. It was like, oh, yeah, the first thing you're going to study is Tibetan medicine.
Because you're right there, I guess.
Yeah, that's what you're going to do. And it just felt like, I don't know, something very... familiar.
What's their culture of natural medicine like? I imagine it's very
Tibetan
strong
medicine.
Yeah,
oh, Tibetan medicine's amazing. Yeah, so that they have that there, but for some reason this family wasn't working with that. Mm. They were putting really strange stuff on this burn, which is not helping, like toothpaste.
Wow.
Mint, they thought, maybe.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Yeah. So, yeah, something shifted there. And just because I was in that really fearless place after nearly dying, I was just like, I was so like, and I know a lot of people who travel understand this mode, but it was a new thing for me the first time. It was like, I'm just really going to be in the unfolding moment. And if my decision will be made from moment to moment according if it feels right mm-hmm. in my gut, you know?
Yep.
And so you could... appear to be really quite ruthless if people come into contact with you. But you just, in your own way, in your own survival, because you're just in the moment to moment, you know what I mean? So then after being in that region of the world of Nepal and Mustang, ended up in Australia.
Ah, okay.
And then the land there just had such an impact on me. A huge impact. It's so ancient. And I ended up on a protest camp.
Oh, right.
In the middle of a national park called Kakadu. Because a British company called Peabody were wanting to mine it for uranium. And if they were going to do this uranium extraction, it was going to pollute major waterways, which then would have... included major waterways throughout Australia, because it's all kind of connected. Wow. The waterways.
And the people obviously knew this.
Yeah. And so everywhere I went, I just was having very huge experiences with the land and people just like sort of just meeting fantastic people. But it was through the land I was having these really profound experiences. And at the protest camp, it was invite by the Aboriginal peoples, the First Nation peoples. So we were living with them. Mm. And just the land was so ancient. And just, yeah. And then after that, so that had a really profound effect on me. And then I heard, I know this sounds really random, I'd heard about this at the protest camp, about this temple in the middle of the rainforest north of Cairns on... the East Coast.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I just heard that amazing things are happening there.
And your inner guidance, gut intuition went, yes, I'm going there.
I'm going there.
Yeah.
And I was hitchhiking everywhere.
Ah, okay.
You know, so, you know, ended up
there. Wow, just living it. Yeah.
Yeah. So ended up there. And because, you know, I grew up with rainforest and I grew up with tropics, like when I went to this rainforest, I was like, oh my God, it's the most ancient rainforest in the world. Because it never went through the ice age.
Ah, okay.
Mm, it's called Daintree.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because as I was hitching up there, I was meeting various Aboriginal peoples and they were saying, where are you going? I'm like, going to Daintree. And they're like, oh, you're going there. and they're like, to them, it was major sacred ground.
Ah, interesting.
Like really sacred ground. And they were just starting to tell me about it. They're like, oh yeah, the rocks are very different there. And so you have like these huge boulders, like as tall as like a house or a big building. And some of them, because obviously very sacred, through the landscape, they found a way in which you can like get to the top of them. Like okay. little, like, I don't know, little steps.
These are in the forest?
Yeah, or, in the rainforest.
Whoa.
Like huge.
Wow.
And they were just saying, go to the rocks and sit on them.
Yeah.
And they're like, in the rocks, it's all quartz crystal.
Hmm.
And they're like, so they're telling me about the rocks and they're telling me about this one beach where you can get these like round little rocks and you just drop them and they bounce like a bouncy ball.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is in that?
I don't know.
That's amazing.
And in a lot of the, what they call the blue holes, like pools of water, I mean, it's turquoise. It's something to do with the
right
sediment.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, you can happily, there's no crocodiles in these waters. You're safe. So they were just saying, just be in the rainforest, be in the waterfalls, just swim in the healing holes. And sit on the rocks.
Sounds great.
And so once I got to this temple, and back then, I mean, it's very different now from what they're doing. And I totally understand why they're doing it now.
So was this, when you say temple, do you mean it was an Aboriginal place or it was something that was set up later?
So it's not Aboriginal place. It was, he's probably Australian. He'd lived in the rainforest like for 30 years. And he had like an open plan wooden house.
Yeah.
And you just call it a temple and like whoever rocked up
could
hang out. But he would teach people meditation.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And back then it was donation. But, you know, he's running it as a proper retreat center now.
Okay.
So like that's when I really.
It's still going.
Still going.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's commitment.
Yeah, no, dedication. I think he met a lady and she's like, right, we're going to run this properly.
Yeah.
You need help.
That's great. That's so good. Yeah.
So.
It sounds magical.
But it was like how he did his, you know, it wasn't like, let's just lie about and do nothing. He was like, we wake up every morning at 5.
Yeah.
We meditate, we do
the discipline was there.
It was like Gayatri mantra. He was like, that's what he taught.
108 times.
Yes.
Every day.
No. So it was that, Gayatri, 108, 5 in the morning, and then meditate for an hour after that. And then do Ashtanga yoga.
Wow.
And then
in
like
the rainforest.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then have your lunch. But the whole day you have your day to do what you want. But then you meet at sundown and do the Gayatri mantra and meditate. So you're like, that's proper.
Yeah, that's full on.
That's full on. Mm. And I was new to it.
Wow. So that was your first experience of like a class situation or like a formally led situation?
Yeah. And I was there for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And it was through that. And then obviously being in that nature, going off on my own to like huge waterfalls and sitting on these rocks and meditating, that I'm starting to have big experiences.
Mm.
Like never had anything like that.
Yeah.
Like dimensional shifts.
Yeah.
you know, and totally no chemicals or herbs part of that dimension.
And still at like a really kind of young unfolding age, right? All that stuff happening to you before you're 20, like,
yeah. Oof. I was like barely 19.
Yeah.
Wow. And then it was there, I was just like, I'm not going back to the UK. I'm not doing anthropology. What is going on? And then I was like, well, I just want to just go more into the healing arts. That's what I want to do. But then I'm like, but there's nowhere and there's not uni which can offer that to me. So I just had to, I was like, okay, I have to go back to the UK and face this. So I did go to uni for one day.
For one day. Brilliant.
Because I was in my fearless.
I'll try it.
For one day.
Yeah.
But what I did, I knocked on the head of anthropology of this uni. It was at UCL in London. I knocked on the front door and I was like, he's like, come in. And I'm like, and I just looked at him. I was just like, I don't know what I was. I just said to him, I'm not supposed to be here. That's what came out of my mouth. And then he looked at me like really bemused. He's like, well, where are you supposed to be?
Good question. That's great.
And then I said, I just don't want to study anthropology. And then he's like, well, then why did you apply? What was it about that you were interested? And I was like, I just really want to study medicinal herbs and study other cultures' medicine practices. And he's like, you're interested in medical anthropology. Well, the good news is you can study that when you're doing a doctorate.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you've got to go through several years of the course first.
Mm. Yeah, and I was like, no, I'm going now.
Yeah. That was it.
And then I remember going back to my mum's and I'm like, Mum, that's it. I went to uni for a day, but I know I'm not supposed to be there. And so she's like, bless her, was so like, you know, obviously anxious, just been on a roller coaster with all of this.
Yeah.
And then she said, what are you going to do? I'm like, oh, I have to go out into the world and study what I want, but I have to find the teachers. And that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. She was like, okay.
She's like, oh God. Just wanted like peace and quiet after getting through, helping me get through school, you know.
Yeah.
She's like, oh God.
And all your health stuff, I guess. Yeah. She's probably a bit like.
Yeah, I nearly died.
Oh God.
Charlotte, you know, her daughter nearly had an overdose on
liquid
speed. I mean, not a good vibe, you know.
Yeah.
You know, in India.
Yeah. And now she's just going to go off and meet her teachers? What?
What is she going to do?
Mm.
So, like, I was born in Miami. So I was just very drawn to also studying as close as possible the medicine from where I was born.
Okay.
But there were no teachers because the First Nation peoples of that part of Florida, I mean, totally decimated.
Yeah, I bet.
And I'm like, well, the closest to that land and those plants, which is pretty much 99.9% exactly the same as in Mexico, in the Yucatan.
Yeah.
Because the Yucatan and Miami, it all used to be the same land.
Yeah, I bet.
So I'm like, right, I'm going to Mexico. And I was really fortunate because it was in the 90s, people could go to uni for free, but also I'd won a grant. So I used my uni grant to go to Mexico and study.
They weren't like, oh, we'd like that back, please.
No, they just gave it to me.
Yeah.
So they couldn't ask for it back. So
I guess a grant is non-refundable.
Yeah. So I was like, well, I'm going to study what I really want to study. So I went off for a few years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. That's so cool, isn't it? That's so cool.
So I first started.
So in a roundabout way, university really helped you out.
Yeah.
Because you got the money to go and do what you really wanted to do.
Yeah. And so I first went to Mexico and there was a, so I was always interested in ceremony. So I studied Mayan ceremony. Wild.
Whoa.
Like for an hour, not for an hour, a year.
Yeah.
As well as the plants. And so the first thing I studied was the ceremony in my classroom, was all the temples. And my teacher, who's Mayan, he lived in Merida, he was like, just go off and work with the ceremony at these temples. And he's like, yeah, and try and go in at night. You know? So I had lots of adventures.
Yeah. Wow. I feel like we could probably talk for several hours about all the things that you've done.
So just to put it in a nutshell, so it started there, but then there was the calling still for Tibetan medicine.
Okay.
And that was just so calling me. And from my experience in Mustang, and I was determined to go and train in it. And at the time, and it's still the way it is, still today, to really study the main school, actually it's not true. There are a few teachers like in America where they're starting to do it now. You would have to go to Dharamsala in the north. First of all, you'd have to learn Tibetan. And the training was 12 years.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't look like the easiest language written, so I don't know how it is spoken.
But yeah.
So I was. You have to learn it written to read the books.
Yeah. So initially I was like, right, you really have to make a decision that this is quite a strong one, you know? And at a very young age, like 21.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I had a friend who was a very incredible acupuncturist, but he practiced a type of acupuncture which had a Tibetan influence. And he's very learned and well connected. And he's like, you don't need to go to Dharamsala. There's this guy in London. Go and check him out before anything. And he teaches in English. And so I was like, great. But before deciding to study with him, I was like, I'm going to receive the treatment for a few months, for 6 months, experience it. Because it's just some strange idea that came to me in the Himalayas, you know. Mm. But then I was just immediately like, wow, this is really profound. Like, wow, like a whole different level.
His work.
His work, but also Tibetan medicine. Yeah. And it was like so deep, but so, I started to realize it was so practical.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided I was going to apprenticeship with him. And I did a really traditional apprenticeship for 8 years. And yeah, where there was no money exchanged. It was literally like...
The time and the, your commitment is... Yeah.
So I was probably doing 3 days in the clinic. And then, you know, after you start to learn stuff, you ended up treating the patients. But it was like, it was an apprenticeship where you did like 6 hours of study a day, 3 hours really early in the morning, 3 hours before you go to sleep, but 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's intense in its own way, right?
Yeah.
It's not learning Tibetan, but it's...
Yeah.
That's really intense.
Yeah.
What sort of clientele was he having?
So, yeah, he treated everyone. And, you know, it's super kind if people couldn't afford it, you know.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And, but, like, Tibetan medicine is, you know, it kind of works on what they call in Ayurveda, the three doshas.
Mm-hmm.
You know about those.
Yeah.
So in Tibetan medicine, we call it the three humors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same. So Vata we call wind. Pitta, that's fire, isn't it? We would call bile in Tibetan medicine.
Yeah.
Kapha we call phlegm.
Okay.
And then so I was, so with Ayurveda and Tibetan medicine, out of all the present medical systems in the world right now, they are medical systems of alchemy, okay? So you hear this word a lot. It's very trendy.
Mm-hmm.
And so alchemy is a system of medicine. And, you know, they talk about it originating in Egypt, but it could have originated in many countries at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, it could have just been where the human consciousness was at.
Yeah.
Sort of observing consciousness. And everyone kind of understood it in the same way. But the word alchemy is that stems from Egypt. Kimia is another name for Egypt.
Okay.
And Al, so when the Persians invaded Egypt, Al is just, yeah, that means Tha.
Mm-hmm.
So it means the Egypt, or Kimia also means the black earth, which Egypt, the Nile was known as the black earth.
Okay, right.
The land around it. What happened, Europe, when it came into contact with Persian cultures, then absorbed this alchemy from there. And a system of medicine was practiced in the UK, totally with, should we say, the three doshas or the three humors.
Was practiced in the UK?
Yeah.
At what time are you sort of talking about here?
God, so...
When are we?
1300s onwards.
Wow.
So, but we wouldn't call it like...
Yeah.
Kapha Pitta. We call it, I'll tell you what it is. And it's like alchemy is... integrated in so much of our culture and we don't know it. And Christianity has really is absorbed it all. Okay, so Vata is heaven. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Heavenly realm.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many layers to this. Okay, so Vata is heaven, but it's also soul. Pitta in Ayurveda is spirit. So you got your soul, you got your spirit. And Kapha is the body.
Okay.
You got soul, spirit, body. Okay. Soul is also seen as heaven. And the body is seen as earth. And spirit is the bridge between heaven and earth. Okay. The Holy Trinity.
I see. Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. And so like when you have Holy Communion, you have the bread, which is the body.
Yeah.
The wine is the spirit. And so you have the body and the spirit. Consume illuminates your soul. That's what it's all about. It's all our alchemical equation.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically been around way longer than Christianity, and over the years,
thousands of years.
I guess it sounds like it's been so. If it was such an ingrained kind of practice into a culture, then that would have just seeped into other cultures.
Yeah.
And then they sort of renamed things. Made it fit their own models and systems.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, like people have this idea that alchemy is the transformation from lead into gold. It's just a metaphor. But if you really to understand what alchemy is, it is the observation of consciousness embodied into matter. And then consciousness leaving matter. Back into consciousness. So it's just following the cycles of the embodiment of consciousness into matter and vice versa, and it's understanding that in the cycles of life and in nature, and also just working with foundations of microcosm, macrocosm, and what is above is below.
But really
we know that, but also once you really are working with it, you're experiencing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I know it more. I didn't know about this kind of the ancient, like medical, the treatment side of things.
Yeah.
I guess I've only really come across it through much later things, like kind of Carl Jung talking about alchemy as a spiritual system of transformation of the individual. But he, as far as I'm aware, I can't remember, but I don't think he talks about it in the medical sense at all. But,
it's very present in Greece as well.
Mm, yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, like in Chinese medicine or in Ayurveda, you know, you have different ways of diagnosing just by when you know it inside out, you can look at someone and be like, ah, that's that dosha. Mm-hmm. You know, just by looking at them or just touching their skin.
Yeah.
And so it's the same, you know, like you could be like, someone's... If you were just going to use English language, you'd be like, oh, they're really in the heaven and there's a balance with their spirit, or they're really, you know, but in Ayurveda, you would be like, oh, they're Vata dominant. And
yeah, I mean, the fundamental kind of aim, I guess, is to return to balance, right? In a lot of healing modalities, shamanic-y sort of system, everyone's looking to balance, bring balance via the extremes of the different elements or forms that you're working with.
Yeah. Yeah, and then with alchemy, I mean, the alchemists were the first chemists.
Mm-hmm.
So they, owe chemistry to them.
So much to thank the Egyptians for, hey?
Yeah. And so then they started experimenting with what they would see in nature, like these huge cycles with even just the water cycle and fermentation and things naturally fermenting. And then, do a microcosm of that in the lab. And so, like, thanks to the Egyptians, and then obviously kind of got changed with, Persian culture as well. It's like distillation, was from alchemists at the time, just observing like water evaporating off the ocean, the seawater, but then coming down as rainwater and there's no salt in it. Okay, why is that? How did they split that? So they found out how to do distillation.
Yeah.
And then also with watching fruit naturally ferment, and that this beautiful thing called alcohol was produced. And what is that? and then distilling that, splitting the spirit, which is the alcohol, from the body.
Mm.
So fermentation is the resurrection. Spirit, alcohol is the resurrected spirit.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
That's great.
And then with essential oil making. So in alchemy, essential oil, or the oil, is seen as the soul.
Okay.
Alcohol is seen as the spirit. And then like a fruit or the herbs.
Yeah.
The physical.
Or the flowers.
That's the body.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing about it is those three components really meet on the microcosm, on the inside of the human. Oil, God, our nervous systems, our brains love it.
Mm. We run on fats, right?
Exactly.
Mostly.
Yeah. it's so absorbed by the brain.
Mm.
And our nervous system, you could say it like this. The nervous system is the vessel which holds our minds, our consciousness. So oil, loved by the nervous system, the brain. And the oil within alchemy is seen as the soul of a plant.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
When we drink alcohol, our bloodstream, our capillaries, everything expands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? In alchemy, the blood is seen as the spirit of the human. And when we eat the fruit, or we take a herbal tea, or those minerals, or that sort of fiber from like an apple, it's absorbed. It really, it's for our bodies. So there's inner, outer.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you know this, but it's our blood which pumps our heart.
The blood that pumps the heart, not the heart that pumps the blood.
Mm. This is scientifically known. It's not some weird alchemy thing.
Yeah. Some weird alchemy thing.
some esoteric. Yeah. Like,
so it's kind of like the heart only pumps because the blood is there.
Yeah, but there's a energy within the blood.
Uh-huh.
A consciousness within the blood, which science hasn't been able to totally
really
grasp.
Yeah. Really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's the spirit. And it pumps our heart. There's an intelligence in our blood. So when people always ask me when we do training days, they're like, well, what's the difference between the soul and the spirit, and the way I explain it is like, okay, imagine soul is heaven and this is body, like body is earth. The spirit is what bridges your soul, brings it into your body. So it's the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this, our bloodstream is infused with this spirit. But deep in our brains and nervous systems is the soul.
Hmm.
And there's this beautiful interchange, actually, which takes place constantly 24/7 between the soul and the spirit on a physical level. And it's in the cranial sacral third.
Okay.
So what happens is in the middle of the brain, there's a ventricle where our beautiful red blood cells go into there and filters and then forms this white fluid. So it goes from red to white. And it forms the white fluid, which is the cranial sacral fluid.
Right.
And the cranial sacral fluid does its thing around all the parts of our brain and, you know, spinal cord. And then it gets reabsorbed back into the bloodstream and forms red blood cells. So it's constantly this interchange between the soul and the spirit on a physical level.
Hmm. That's beautiful. Yeah, I've never heard it described like that either.
Yeah.
Kind of makes you reflect on your body a bit differently, right?
Yeah.
Like, or the awareness of what's actually going on.
Yeah. So there's constantly this bridging between the soul and the spirit.
Hmm.
In the body all the time,
hmm,
on a physical level.
Hmm. And that would be what your, I guess that's what these kind of systems that you're working with would be, that's how you would devise a treatment, right?
Yeah. So the beautiful thing about Tibetan medicine, even though it seems so like weird and esoteric, you know, when you kind of like just seeing it from the outside, but like with the acupuncture, there's a lot of cranial acupuncture on the head and yeah, down the spine. He's like, no, it's not Chinese medicine. Nothing to do with meridian, Charlotte. He's like, this is so beyond practical. He's like, we are literally needling the nervous system. So he's like, when the cranial acupuncture, he's like, we're needling different parts of the cranial nerves, which will affect different parts of the brain. We're like needling different... So nerve channels. And this is what he said to me. He's like, if you can affect the nervous system, you affect the mind.
Yeah.
When you affect the mind, you affect a person's consciousness. When you affect someone's consciousness, you can affect their soul. He's like, the nervous system is the gateway into the soul because it's the vessel which holds the soul. He's like, this is why this is Tibetan acupuncture.
Yeah, and I guess modern, I guess in these sort of the days that we live in now, you know, people talk about the nervous system with a lot more reverence and a lot more importance, yeah, just in general about like, well, where does your kind of your base for your general health, the immune system, yeah, but your nervous system. People talk about it loads more now. Have you noticed?
Yeah, like, because this is understanding our culture to do with trauma.
Because we're so overstimulated in many ways, yeah, and the nervous system is so kind of like troubled in many people. Yeah, there's a real, I feel that in that sort of rising, you know, the awareness of people a lot more, people talk about that a lot more now.
And all the practices.
Yes.
You know, like the Wim Hof.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cold water.
Yeah, yeah.
The pranayama.
Yeah.
The yoga.
So much. Even just like lying down and resting.
Yeah.
Simple stuff.
Yeah.
Just really simple stuff.
Yeah.
Resetting.
Yeah. But also I think, I mean, it's not fully in the mainstream yet, but this understanding of like our Western culture is a culture of individualization. And how stressful that is, mm-hmm, on our nervous systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of chat is starting to happen of, yeah, we need to get into that culture of inclusivity, and then our nervous systems are going to be like, ah, mm, you know what I mean, as well. Mm. Mm. And with feeling connected to nature and in the natural world and the plants and foraging. And
yeah. And again, yeah, it's like why people love going to be in nature, right? Even if they don't understand it.
Yeah.
It's kind of that relaxation on a level of the nervous system affecting all the other parts.
Yeah.
Hmm. Thanks. That's so, I love how you've broken that down, and there's such a beautiful picture, a way of understanding. Yeah.
Of alchemy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's practical. It's not as, you know.
Yeah.
It's only been painted as esoteric because it wanted to be kept secret. because certain people in power, whether it's, you know, different dynasties or whoever the monarch was, they wanted to abuse whatever for their own gain.
Yeah, or control who gets access to what.
Their own gain.
Yeah.
So what happened was the alchemists, the original people who had the recipes, I'm just giving you an example, for gunpowder.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, okay, well, we need cannons now, so we're going to make sure these chemists give us what we want.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that's actually something which happened in my family lineage.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So from doing like ancestry work, my surname is Pulver. The word Pulver, pulverize.
Okay.
So it's a trade name.
Right.
For an apothecarian or alchemist to grind to powder. Because, you know, it's blacksmith.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tailor. Pulver is a trade name. A wow. really ancient pre-Roman trade name for apothecarian alchemist.
How perfect.
Yeah.
When did you learn that?
I remember when I was asking my dad, I was like, Dad, what does our name mean? Like really early. He's like, oh, we're like gunpowder makers. I'm like, no, we're not. That's wrong. I just knew, like, you know, kids have this weird.
Yeah. Like, bullshit meter.
I was like, no. And then I was like starting to talk to other relatives on his side who were like herbalists and stuff. They're like, no, it's definitely not gunpowder makers because in the family crest, it's a unicorn. That's not gunpowder. And then, like, I don't know, because I didn't get to talk to them because I was over here, like, from the age of 10. But then in my teens, I remember just reading up about it just to do with the name. And it was like, oh, yeah, pre-Roman trade name for apothecarians. And then I was talking to one of my uncles who's herbalist. And he's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're on the right track there.
Yeah. And what happened is in the 1500s. So it's a German name.
Okay.
So it would have been on the border with France, the Rhine, in the Rhine area. And I mean, you go there, it's just, there's such ancient roots to, they have like apothecary museums and everything in that area still today. And so what I was reading through my ancestry research was during the witch trial era and all that sort of reformation coming in is, so these peoples, the Pulvers, were like, okay, if you want to live, give us your gunpowder understanding of how to make it. Because it's actually not easy.
I see.
Yeah. And you can then live.
Yeah.
But you will then be known as the gunpowder makers.
So it was, yeah.
The trade-off. Yeah.
Wow, history is crazy like that, right?
Yeah. But once I discovered it, like something lifted off.
Well, yeah. I mean, it couldn't be more perfect, right?
It lifted off and without wanting to sound too woo-woo and, you know, but like honestly, since I did my ancestry work, like a lot of people say like, how do you know all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I just feel like a direct connection to my ancestors. And the information comes from there.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's honestly.
Yeah.
And not wanting to sound woo-woo, but yeah.
No, well, that's real.
Yeah. But that's
real stuff.
That's the experience.
Yeah. Wow, how magical. It's so great that you were able to get into that mindset of exploration and kind of learning and curiosity at such a young age. And it seems like you've just followed what was very naturally unfolding path for you.
Yeah.
Like you're where you're meant to be sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does it feel like that?
Definitely.
Sounds like it.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. So how do you currently offer the work that you're doing with the alchemy, Charlotte?
So the main way is I make medicines. But if you really want to learn about alchemy, I mean, for me, the best thing ever is teaching and passing on a foundational understanding of a system of alchemy with people. And we go off and connect with the consciousness of plants, which actually is the most important thing.
Yeah, that kind of like, that sort of spirit approach to plant spirit approach to herbalism.
Exactly. Yeah, because in our culture, our culture is so based on, to know something you have to be told it
in a book.
You have to be told it by someone who knows, or you got to read it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, my whole thing, and it's also is because I did a Tibetan medical apprenticeship where my teacher was so friggin' old school.
Mm-hmm.
And like at the time, I was in my 20s, early 20s when I started. I didn't understand why he was teaching me the way he was, and I was always quite angry at him as a result, because he was like, I mean, don't read it. You're going to experience it first, and I'm not going to tell you.
That's an amazing way to learn, though.
So what he used to do, and he was like, he was such a trickster. As everything was like, you know, quite a joke, you know, that kind of heyoka or whatever trickster. He was like, okay, so I'm going to teach you this technique of, I don't know how to do this acupuncture. I'm not going to tell you what it does. And you're going to treat that person, and you're going to then tell me what it does. And I'm like, that's how he taught.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
And I just thought he was taking the piss the whole time.
Having come from a system of like Western learning, I guess that's like so alien.
Yeah. And that's how he taught the whole time. I was super playful and like, obviously I'd been through the whole British school system. So I just thought it was wasting my time and being a bit of a dick. But after going through that, I am so grateful I had him as a teacher and I was taught in that way. So when people come and learn how to make medicines with them, I'm like, I'm not going to tell you what this plant does. We're going to go out. This is the technique of how to connect with the consciousness of plants. Go and connect with it. Come back and then share with me in a group what the plant told you.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so everyone does this. And like 99% of what people will receive is completely correct. Because
mm-hmm.
through, you know, using your senses, which is essentially the main technique is about using your five senses, what happens, and I explained to it on a neurobiological level, your five senses go to the center of your brain. The center of your brain is what is called the ancestral brain, the mammalian brain. You start to open up the channels in your nervous system of things about that knowledge of when you just know. It's that ancestral mind. And it's just in our culture, we're not using it every day, like exercising our muscles.
But well, it's a lot about trust as well, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's about feeling.
Mm.
If you really allow yourself to be in your senses, like look at the plant, ask it what its medicine. But also I say to people, it's like, okay, you're going to use your senses and the question you're going to ask is what is your medicine? But the information that comes back, I give you full permission not to filter it. It doesn't matter how weird it is or how abstract it is.
Mm.
Write it down, what comes through. It's really important. Something really important might be communicated to you. And so I go in the reverse. I go in that way of like, you're going to experience it. We're going to share it. And then we're going to read it in the book. And I find that is so important that way round, is because when we meet the consciousness of a plant with our consciousness, something very powerful and profound happens where a union takes place and you can feel the plant coming to you. It's like you know it on such an intimate level. And if I go to someone and say, this is what this plant does, X, Y, and Z, it is totally taken away their experience of being able to meet the consciousness of the plant, because that will kind of infiltrate their understanding.
Yeah.
And you've taken that away from them for the rest of their life.
So you're teaching, how does your teaching look at the moment? Have you got things that you're doing this year?
Yeah. So the main way in which people come is come for a medicine making day.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it at different parts of the year, like during the equinoxes and solstices and
mm-hmm.
with what's seasonally around. And we go from beginning to end. So we start with connecting with the consciousness plant. Then we go into distillation. So we make hydrosols, which is essential oil is extracted, as well as the cellular waters. I teach about tincture making and oil making, and you know, all the other yummy things as well.
Yeah.
And And I mainly teach that work in a place called the Apothecary Garden, which is in Somerset.
Mm.
It's just an incredible place to learn.
Sounds great.
And it's got a 50-litre copper still.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's just really yummy.
Yeah,
it's like a real gift. And like, for example, like in the summer, like May and June, there's like thousands of organic flowers, like organic roses just blooming.
Mm.
And where do you have that in the UK where you can forage thousands of organic roses, which haven't been sprayed with pesticides and distill them in a huge copper still?
Wow, what a place.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so they've got, what's it called again?
The Apothecary Garden.
Okay.
In Somerset.
Yeah, so people can look that up if they want to see what you're offering there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then if you want to have medicines, I make various medicines as well. People contact me from all around the world and I send all over. Coming back to the apothecary and the unicorn. So the unicorn is the symbol of the trade of apothecaries.
Okay.
So, you know, in like London, you have the London Guilds, the ancient guilds in the city. Well, the oldest one is the Guild of Apothecaries.
Hmm.
It's been present in London since 1100.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so each trade, and this is like pre-Roman, would have its own symbol, because if you were like in a market street, if you had like, I don't know, a golden unicorn above the shop of an apothecary, you know, oh, the unicorn, I got to go and get my herbs or whatever. So above the Guild of Apothecaries, the building in London, are two golden unicorns, you know, because that's the ancient symbol. When I found out about the Guild of Apothecaries, I was like, oh God, I want to go there, you know, because my family probably, you know, ancient ancestors, like, and I need to connect with the unicorns. And I just really want to see this amazing building. It looks amazing.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know how it happened. It was so long ago. It's very different now about how you can get in and walk around this amazing place. But anyway, I was walking around and I was like, I really want to become a member. And they're like, oh, are you a GP? Are you a surgeon? And I'm like, no, I'm a herbalist. I essentially am an apothecary and it's in my family.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if I have some relatives who are very much connected to the guild. I told them my name and they're like, oh, right, okay. They're like, but don't you understand that this is only for medicine? Like those who work in the medical profession can be a member.
What?
Yeah.
That's not even what it means.
And it was so weird. I looked at them and I was just like,
wow.
And I looked at them, I was like, don't you know that before, like paracetamol and stuff like that, that's like from the willow tree?
Yeah, that's what medicine's based on.
I said, all our medicine today is based on the plants.
Yeah.
And this guy, a kid in your looked at me, he was like, oh, yes, you're right.
Oh, like it was goodness. like he just realized it.
Yeah. And I'm like, it's, and I just looked at him and was like, it's very sad that I said, you're like a total reflection of actually the disconnect. And then this is when it got funny. He's like, darling, you can become a member. I can tell you how you can become a member of the Guild of Apothecaries. You can volunteer to help in the library with the restorations of the books. And we have a special name for them. We call them unicorns.
You're a unicorn. Or you could be.
Could be. Anyway, so I've been there a few times looking at the amazing books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you get your membership?
I didn't apply for it. I didn't get that organised.
Yeah.
And I don't live in London anymore. So.
Yeah. Man, that's so weird the way that it sounds like the whole institution has been sort of taken over. Like even redefining, they lost the link between what an apothecarian is.
Yeah.
That's mad.
I know, it's totally
given
mad.
It's such a long-standing institution, that's
and
kind
the oldest
of,
one.
That's very sad. Well, I think you're doing it the right way, Charlotte. You're doing it your way.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, it's
really
great to
appreciate
chat.
Appreciate it. It's fascinating. It's really fascinating. Yeah. Thank you.
Pleasure. Lovely to chat.
Hi, it's Jody again. Thank you, as always, to Six Organs of Admittance for the intro and outro music, also known as Ben Chasney, and Drag City Records. And you can find his music at sixorgans.com or dragcityrecords.com. To keep in touch with me, you can follow my personal Instagram, which is Life in Fractals. To keep up with the podcast episodes, it is Lumiere's Podcast on Instagram. And you can check out my website, jodywhite.co.uk, for all sorts of other things related to the work that I do, and my book, Chimera, which is out now and available at all good online retailers and a very select few independent bookshops. It's also available on bookshop.org if you'd rather not support Jeffrey Bezos. All the links are at my website, jodywhite.co.uk/chimera. And if you really enjoyed this episode and you're thinking, hey, how can I support Jody make more of these podcasts and continue to go out and meet and talk to wonderful, interesting, inspiring people, then you can. You can go to patreon.com/Jody White. And if you choose to do so, my deepest thanks to you in advance. We found our way. The light.